Hello, I'm Father Ray Petrucci. Welcome to Thoughts for the Week. We are going to have a great show today, and I look forward to getting to it. Before we do and introducing our guest, I would like to bring you, our listeners, the opportunity to contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Any ideas, themes, areas where you'd like us to try to cover, maybe do a couple programs for you, please let us know. I'd like to give you two ways to get us. That is by regular, good old-fashioned mail and also email. Now, if you wish to put a stamp on a letter and send it to us, please do so at the following address, Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466, Greenwich, Connecticut. That's Post Office Box 7466, Greenwich, Connecticut. The zip code in Greenwich is 06836. That's 06836. If you're on the computer and you would prefer to email us, do so at the following email address, and that would be Clemens, the number 10, at AOL.com. Let me spell that for you. That's C-L-E-M-O-N-S, the number 10, at AOL.com. While you're on the computer, I invite you to go to our internet magazine, Spirituality for Today. You can find that at spirituality.org, spirituality.org. And while you're there, not only can you read some articles and features, but also you can listen to Thoughts for the Week. We have many, many programs archived there, and look at a topic you might be interested in listening to and go right ahead. So we have a number of opportunities for you to contact us and also to listen to what we at Clemens Productions produce. So welcome to all of you, our listeners. Now, just to let you know that my co-host, Dorothy Riera, could not be with us today. She couldn't join us, but I am delighted to welcome our guest, and that is, we'd like to welcome Dr. Janie Leatherman. And Dr. Leatherman is the chair of the Department of Politics, and she has a number of other titles. We'll get into some of the other areas that she's involved in. But chair of the Department of Politics at Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. So, Dr. Leatherman, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
We're delighted to have you here today. Politics, wow. Boy, I'll tell you, probably more interesting or interest in politics now than it has been in a long, long time. I'd love to get a little bit more about your own background and coming to Fairfield U and getting involved in this area. So can you give us just a little background on yourself of how you reached where you are now?
Wow, that's a big question. A short one, but a big one. I grew up in the Church of the Brethren, which is one of the historic peace churches in the United States. Oh, so there's the Mennonites, the Quakers, the Amish, and the Brethren. And those four have traditionally been referred to as the historic peace churches. Mm. So actually, on my father's side, the name Leatherman is one of the historic names in the Church of the Brethren. Mm. They came to the U.S. from Germany and started to settle the Church of the Brethren in the Pennsylvania area and other parts of the East Coast. So I was raised in that tradition.
Where were you?
I was raised in Ohio.
Oh, Ohio. Yeah. Oh, Ohio. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
I was raised in Ohio, and I was deeply influenced by the kinds of social justice and peace commitments of the church. And actually, one of my uncles was a pastor in the Church of the Brethren. And when it came time to go to college, I decided to go to Manchester College. It's one of the Church of the Brethren schools. And I majored in peace studies. It is one of the first peace studies programs in the world. It was established after World War II.
Huh. And so
deep roots. And deep roots.
Indeed.
Peace,
so
and
you kind of grew up with an atmosphere.
I grew up in the tradition.
Spiritual atmosphere of and tradition of peace, which, of course, brings you now to the work you're doing at the university. I realize you chair the entire department. Is there any particular area that you are focused in yourself?
Yeah, my own specialty falls in the area of international relations, as it refers to political science. But my PhD is actually in international studies, which is somewhat broader. So international studies is an interdisciplinary field, whereas political science is its own discipline. So in the study of international studies, we take into account political science, and obviously the international relations side of it is one of the heavy components of international studies. But I also had coursework in other fields, so some in conflict resolution and political psychology and diplomacy, historiography, a number of different kinds of fields. Right.
Now, when we take a look, of course, in the news today, there's a great deal of news, as we shall say, in the international field. Let's take a look. I think one of the biggest thing is, and I believe that you have also, of course, involvement with the area of something called border politics.
Yes.
Now, am I assuming correctly that you're talking about just all the borders or specifically Mexico?
No, borders in general around the world.
Although
my own interest was in some way inspired by the work of Father Sean, who leads the Kino Border Initiative in Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico. So I actually went to that area and did some field work and learned about the kind of programs that they had to minister to migrants and provide safe keeping for especially women and girls.
When you take a look at that problem, it seems, please help me, I seem to understand of the area of migration and another question regard to the drug trafficking and maybe human trafficking. I don't know if, but if I might just take a peek at the migration area, when you think of the problem, I kind of look at it and I see Mexico, from their point of view, they might say, well, look, you've invited or you look for all of these immigrants to come into your country and to work in your fields and do all these types of things. So in a way, you complain about them being there, but you've, in essence, invited them there. And I can see from the American point of view saying, what's wrong with you guys? You can't keep your citizens secure. You can't provide work for them. And you're making us feel badly because we want to build a wall. Where are we? do you think is part of the problems with the situation?
I think in most parts of the world, and certainly Mexico-U.S. relationship fits this kind of paradigm, there's push-pull factors involved in migration. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that it's easy for people to contemplate migrating to another country. As a university student, I thought about going abroad, and I did. I lived in Spain a couple of years. I studied a couple of years in Spain as an undergraduate and later returned to Spain a couple of times and worked and studied abroad. But that wasn't an easy decision for me, and I was just going by myself, right? And not under duress or fear for my life in my own home. So I think that that's a weighty decision for people to migrate, especially if they see that there are difficulties feeding their families, taking care of their children, or threats to their own personal security. So there are significant kinds of push factors that compel people to undertake what often is a perilous journey. And some estimates would indicate that 8 out of 10 women who migrate through Mexico to the United States, whether they're coming from Mexico or from Central America, which is often the case, 8 out of 10 face rape. So even so endemically that they prepare for that. So these aren't easy decisions that people make. And we see the same sort of phenomenon from the Middle East with the flow of migration to Europe over the last couple of years that's been so dramatic. But there are people coming from as far away as Afghanistan and also other countries in Africa, not just Syria and Iraq, which are two major sources of migration flows to Europe. But these people are also similarly fleeing endemic poverty and violence and threats to the safety of their family. And I'm sure that they don't undertake this journey lightly. It's probably their last choice. And so we don't tend to think about the ones that make it as the real success stories, as the real survivors, as the people that have got lots of wits and skills about them to be able to manage such a daunting proposition. And one of the things that I try to teach my students in the border politics class is that oftentimes we're moving through the same spaces in the world, those who are privileged and those who are on the margins. And we don't often see it that way. But the ones in the on the margins try to stay in the shadows for their own safety. So we don't often recognize that they're in our midst. But there's a kind of remarkable channels of movements of people that juxtapose privilege with extreme deprivation.
You can imagine that is a desperate thing to try to do. The situation in a person's own country, whatever, wherever it may be, has become and reached a point where, for the sake of survival, you just have to get out and go somewhere. Can we assume most of these migrants who emigrate from one country into another, that most of them would like to really go back to their homeland once things can become peaceful, or at least become set up to such a degree that they could thrive there? Or do you feel that once they get out, that they truly want to make a new life in a new land? I know it's a very general statement, but...
Right. I think it's hard to generalize about that. For some people, the risks that they faced at home might have been so severe that they don't see a possibility of return for a long time, because those conditions might not ameliorate for years and years and years until there's a major change of government, for example. Or if they were targeted by people in their own community, would they be able to safely go back home if a neighbor was the person who, you know, killed their brother or their son or their wife or what it might be like that? So there can be some reasons why people flee and feel that their only alternative is asylum in another country. And
create a new life.
And the imperative to start over and to create a new life. And one of the reasons why I say that this is not an easy decision for people is because at home they might have been engineers, lawyers, doctors, teachers, any number of professions, and when they move, they lose their credentials. And they may not know the language of the country to which they arrive. So even to become recredentialed means, at the very least, learning a new language. If you're 45 or 50 years old or older, that becomes a really daunting proposition. Our brains just aren't that, you know, adaptable to language acquisitions late in life. So the hurdles are very significant. So for many people, leaving their home countries and migrating means a loss of status and a loss of income and obviously loss of an entire, you know, family heritage, really.
And usually there's also a language barrier that makes it even more difficult.
Yes. So for many like refugee families, for example, migrant families, children are their future. And you will see in interviews, the parents will say, you know, the future is for my children. They don't see it so much for themselves. And so to the extent that children may even be born in the new country, whether it's the United States or another country we're talking about, they will go to school. They will quickly learn the local language, English or whichever country we're in, and they become, you know, kind of critical interlocutors between their family and the community, because they're the ones that understand, you know, both the family situation, the family language, and the local cultural context and language better, in some cases, than the family members, the parents or elder members of their family might. So you can see that over time, the proposition of going back home becomes more complicated. If your children are now citizens of the country that you moved to because they were born there, and it happens in the United States, and they've become well integrated into our culture or the host country culture, can they easily move back home and do well and flourish if they haven't been schooled in the native language like the parents were? How would they fit in? So it becomes increasingly complicated over years when families are outside of their home country for that reintegration to happen easily and successfully for the entirety of the family. So, I mean, I think for some people, the dream is always to go back home, and they would try to do that no matter what. For others, they may see that there's not a future in the community they left, and that they have to put all their efforts into their new home. So I think it depends a great deal on the circumstances of each family.
When I think of my own history, my father came over from Italy in the early years of the 20th century, and as a very young boy. But I remember maybe a couple, 20 years ago or so, that there actually were people who had come over from Italy or their children who come over, and they kept that strong relationship with the home country. And some of them were going to retire and head back to Italy. But you had changes that made it, you know, it was a much different reality that even though they're desperate when they left, it became something where the home country was now certainly a much more stable place.
Right.
And they could thrive very, very well, you know, what they brought in. So it's a situation where I can imagine that, let's say, a host country, and I'm thinking of our own situation in the United States, would those who wish to enter the United States, let's say from especially the Latin American countries or South America or wherever, especially those with a lot of tension, a lot of desperation of people, is the best thing to have a pathway to citizenship, to use a familiar term, or is something where the people themselves maybe might be content with some sort of work visa or a residential visa? I guess I'm looking for the type of solution, and how many would we, let's say in America, would be immigration? How important is it to have immigrants coming into this country?
Well, you know, based on some of the conversations I had when I was in the Nogales, Arizona area, it's clear that there are farmers in the southwest of the United States who really need the migrant labor. Mm-hmm. And listening to them, it would seem that a good regional solution would be some kind of a work permit, so that people were regulated, that this was appropriately administered, that there were mechanisms so they could come when the need was high. And so some business interests in that sense would dictate some kind of a work permit program that should be possible to administer and oversee, and probably would work well for people coming from Mexico and wanting to go back home, not wanting to move their entire families, but then benefiting from the kind of income that they could make in the United States and bringing it back home. And in many of those cases, the dream is to accumulate enough resources to start up your own business back home. I mean, I think this is a typical kind of immigrant story. So to the extent that we could look for mechanisms like that, I think it could work. It's like a win-win solution. In other cases, if someone is fleeing oppression, gang violence, which is endemic in parts of Central America, that's extraordinary rates of homicide in those areas, some of the highest in the world, then people are fleeing for different kind of circumstances. And again, going back home might not seem like a real possibility for people like that. So there need to be longer-term solutions for those kind of circumstances, whether for undocumented children or for families who are fleeing violence. But we don't seem to have a very good system for dealing with. I mean, we're more oriented towards refugees in the war context, but we're not so well equipped to think about other kinds of displaced persons. So there's many causes of forced migration. Climate can be one cause for forced migration, and we see some examples of that nowadays. Probably we'll see much more in the future. But we also see forced migrations from causes that relate to criminal activity. So if you look at gang activity and the drug cartels and the kind of violence that is linked to those, it poses often severe risks at many levels of society, and certainly to youth. So families that are fleeing that kind of persecution need other kinds of remedies.
Now, I'm certainly seen enough documentaries about from that area that you're speaking of the drug cartels, of, you know, the drugs come over from the South up into the United States, and the money and guns come from the United States back into the South.
This is true.
You know, they got the great economy going on. Would you think that we ourselves would find it easier to deal with our side of the border as far as working on criminal activity, drug activity, even though it doesn't seem like the war on drugs have been very successful over the past decades? But
no. Such a complicated situation. And sometimes I think we lose sight of what the root causes are. And we're more apt or more comfortable in some sense to respond to the symptoms, which really don't alleviate what's pushing these problems to begin with. So, you know, when I was in Nogales, I talked to some women who had fled their local villages, and I tried to get a sense of why would you do this? Like, why would you take this risk to migrate with your children, in some cases, on a perilous journey north? And, you know, they're leveraging every kind of resource possible. In some cases, they've borrowed money, and their families are now in severe debt. If they don't repay it, family members could be killed. So the pressure to succeed is enormous. So that just to pay the debt back for the journey itself is a compelling reason to persevere, right? But so I try to get a sense, you know, like what's driving this? Like how is it so bad at home? And I remember some of the women explaining that, well, no matter how much I work, I can hardly afford like a dozen of eggs to feed my family for a week. And when you see the relationship between the kind of lack of employment opportunities and the difficulty of just surviving day to day, you can understand the kind of desperation that might make people leave for some other opportunity. Yeah. So could we do something more about economic development in areas where there's such severe deprivation? And I think it's possible to look at numbers of immigrants, let's say, coming from Mexico, identify, you know, what parts of Mexico they're coming from, where the pockets of the deepest poverty are, or where's the most severe drug violence, that sort of thing, and say, you know, what kinds of policies could we adopt that would start to address the problem at the root? So if we think about the push-pull factors, then what's the push? You know, what's pushing these people to leave? How could we make their lives livable in terms of human dignity and human rights protections? How could we ensure that where they're from? And I think most people's first choice would be to stay where they are with their family and their friends and their community, rather than abandon all that. And frankly, when people migrate and they're undocumented in the United States, they have family crises that emerge, like all of us do. And I know some of the women I talked to had to leave and go back to Mexico to care for a grandmother who was ill, or a mother who was ill, or another family member. Some of them took a daughter with them to help. And now they can't get back to the United States, and the families are separated. So you can imagine the excruciating choices that you would have to make. I have a baby with my husband in New Jersey, and yet I need to go back and take care of my mother or my grandmother.
Well, now we're talking about somewhat to almost like communities in terms of families, sort of rooted in two different places.
Yes.
How about the, I guess I'm thinking of the cities, coming to Miami, coming to Los Angeles, huge, very, very large Spanish-speaking populations where I guess a person can live their lives without ever having to learn English. Is this something, of course, your involvement was in Arizona for the most part, but is this something that can become a bridge for, let's say, the United States dealing with the governing factors in the state itself? You're not going out of the country, but yet you have communities, not only with the undocumented, but long citizens who are so bilingual, and their culture is so imbued in the U.S. State situation that they can actually become a conduit for helping people who are coming in to become acculturated and maybe lead to citizenship?
Yeah, I think definitely we have communities across, especially the southern parts of the United States, Texas and California, that whole region, where historically, you know, we have close ties with Mexico. The lands were, in many cases, previously,
Mexico.
You know,
Mexico.
Part of Mexico. So it wouldn't be surprising that we have historical communities that share, you know, those affinities because they come from that tradition. So there's a whole literature on what's referred to as the borderlands, and very rich and interesting kind of literature. I myself, you know, grew up in Northwest Ohio, but very close to Lake Erie, and we were just a stone's throw from the Canadian border. And so I think that people who live in border regions tend to see themselves in a more complex kind of way, in a more multifaceted kind of way, than people who are far from borders. So for sure, people that live in these kinds of communities are natural, like mediators, you could say, between the United States, other host communities in the United States, and the cultures that people are bringing from outside the U.S.
Let me, as you know, we're very close to the end of the program, this particular program we're doing. I'm just wondering, what attitude would you like to see America have toward immigration or toward those who do migrate into this country?
Well, I would like to put it in a slightly larger context because this is a global phenomenon. And if you look at the United Nations reports in the last couple of years, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has indicated that we are facing unprecedented numbers across the globe of people who are forcibly displaced. So last year, the total number was 65 million people. So this is of historic proportions, something that we haven't seen since World War II. And some 65 countries around the world have moved towards the solution of putting fences or border walls, some kind of construction like that, on their borderlands. So we can have some kind of reactionary policy that's not going to solve the problem, or we can start to ask ourselves, where are most of the refugees and displaced persons coming from? What can we do to assist them to stay in their own home countries? And those who have settled in third countries, how can we best integrate and assimilate them to our culture so that we promote good community relations and good family development?
Well, phenomenally, we've reached the end of this program. I'd like to thank you for being here, Dr. Leatherman, and we'll get back to our listeners. Thank you. God bless.